Utena had made the transit from one dimension to another, without the aid of a ship, once before. But she'd been unconscious at the time, and so had missed it. It wasn't as traumatic as she'd been half expecting. Except for the color of the light, it was more or less the same as being beamed somewhere. One moment she was in the workshop. The next she was standing in a long, vault-ceilinged room, almost like a cathedral. At the far end, Vigdis Brightblade heard the shimmering sound of the transition and whirled. "You!" she snapped, and her sword flashed into her hand again. "You should have taken advantage of Lady Vertandi's naivete in rescuing you, witch!" snarled the Valkyrie, advancing. "Now you'll feel the sting of justice!" Utena had just enough time to sigh as she drew her sword and prepared to defend herself. Some days it just seemed like she couldn't buy her way out of having to fight some stupid duel. Oh well, at least this one was for a good cause. Not for Corwin's heart, of course, that was stupid. But of all the reasons one could have to take up arms against another, keeping that other from skewering one was pretty high on Utena's worthwhile list. Bell's warning had not been in vain. Vigdis was good, very good, with her silvery blade. But Utena Tenjo was no slouch either, and right now she was good and mad, a state of mind which, any of her duelist opponents from the Otori Academy days could tell you, made her the most dangerous foe she could be. The scarlet runes on the Thorn's black blade crackled with light as she clashed with the littlest Valkyrie, back and forth up the long stone room. Vigdis noticed them after one particularly close cross-in block, and hissed with outrage, thrusting her opponent back. "You dare wear the Creed of the Valkyrie on your sword?" she snarled. "You dare claim your shadowy blade was cast in the name of God? How can this be?" Utena laughed mirthlessly. "Huh. My shadowy blade was forged by the hands of Corwin Ravenhair. Its enchantments laid with the help of the Master Weaponsmith of Asgard," she replied. "You figure it out." Vigdis blinked, almost dropping her guard, and stumbled back against Utena's furious assault. "That's impossible," she said. "Lady Skuld would not have..." Then her eyes narrowed, and she riposted viciously. "A trick!" she cried, and black runes, the same inscription, appeared on the flat of Vornigard. The blade's black aura slashed and crashed again and again with the scarlet one glowing around the thorn. Utena had started this little dance angry. Now she advanced to downright wrathful. It really got on her nerves the way Vigdis kept dismissing everything that didn't fit into her whacked little worldview as a trick, evil sorcery, or some kind of foul plot on her part. And the accusation the little Valkyrie had laid, that ate at what little remained of her patience, too. After the night she'd had, Utena was in no mood to suffer this kind of foolishness. Raw power snapped around the combatants as they grew more and more furious. It bled from the collisions of their blades like shrapnel, scoring charred divots in the stone floor and walls of their arena. The crash of each meeting of weapons cracking or shattering panes in the nearest mullioned windows. They drove against each other's guard without pause, without hesitation, and without fear. It occurred suddenly to Utena that this was for real. There was no rose on her chest or her opponent's. This wasn't for a mysterious prize, the revolution of the world, or bragging rights. It was for keeps. "If you don't put up your sword now," Akio Otori had told her, sneering, "you'll find out how terrifying real duels are." But this wasn't terror. This was exultation. A tremendous primal thrill raced through her body, blending with the righteous fury that had driven her to engage in this battle to form something new, something almost intoxicating in its power. The Thorn of the Rose sang in her hand, its power crackling back along the nerves in her arm and setting her whole body afire. Here was a worthy opponent, the worthiest since Akio. For all his soullessness and venal cruelty, the man was the greatest swordsman in Sephiro, and facing him had been her greatest challenge. Vigdis Brightblade, on a good day, might have been better. But any of Utrina's old opponents, with the exception of Akio himself, would readily assert that, when she really got going, Utrina Tenjo was all but unstoppable. Properly motivated, she was an inferno, an elemental force that swept down all before it. The power awoke within her, its white light highlighting the thorn's scarlet fire rather than blending with it, shining from the prince's accents on her black and red uniform. All the windows in the hall, which had only cracked or remained unharmed altogether, exploded outward in a silent blaze of white. Vigdis Brightblade recoiled in astonishment and horror as the transfigured Grand Duelist swept in for the kill. Vortigern flew in a high arc, black lightning still crackling over its surface. Where it touched the floor, it blasted out a crater, then remained embedded in the surface below, standing upright in the center of the smoking dish of stone. Utrina Tenjo seized a fistful of the disarmed Valkyrie's tunic in her right hand, the thorn of the rose drawn back. Vigdis gritted her teeth, her green eyes staying defiantly open, as she prepared to spit her dying curse at the witch who had defeated her. Then, to her amazement, Utrina sheathed the thorn of the rose, seized Vigdis's tunic in both hands, hoisted her off the floor, and plunked her roughly down on one of the stone benches that flanked the hall in which they'd dueled. Then she dropped into a catcher's crouch, leaning forward with her nose almost touching Vigdis's, and bored into the Valkyrie with her furious azure eyes. "Listen," snapped the Prince of Sephiro, "because I am only going to tell you this once." Vigdis Brightblade's instinctive reaction was that it had to be a lie. It simply had to. It was such a wild story, it simply could not be true. The witch was just trying to confuse her, making up this long, complicated yarn. Did she seriously expect Vigdis, who was, after all, a Valkyrie, not some common, stupid schoolgirl, to believe that she was from the forbidden and mysterious Tenth World, whose existence the Aesir Council would not even officially confirm? It was like a human claiming to be from Lost Atlantis. And a prince? And all that stuff about the previous prince not quite being dead and... But, well, liches were not unheard of in worlds as magically active as this account made Sephiro out to be. And so he'd manipulated her, and he'd deceived her, and And so Vigdis had unknowingly accused her of doing the very same to Corwin. The rage in those blue eyes. That couldn't be fake. Vigdis could tell herself it had to be. She could sniff derisively and try to look away, but if she looked into those eyes, really looked, then she knew. Knew, and all her bravado melted away and left her shivering with the knowledge of how wrong she had been. "Saved me from all that, and taught me how to enjoy life again," she was saying. Vigdis had gotten so lost in contemplation that she'd lost the thread of the pink-haired girl's dissertation for a moment. She picked it up again immediately, though, as Utrina went on in a voice filled with quiet intensity. "That's what Corwin Ravenhair means to me. Do you understand? So don't you ever, ever say that I've bewitched him, or that I'm using him, or that I don't love him. Ever! Got it?" Utrina paused, ran her hand through her thick pink hair, and shook her head disgustedly. "You're lucky," she told Vigdis. "You don't know how lucky you are. If Corwin were less of a man, if he were willing to have taken what you've been so eager to give him, you'd understand what I mean. Because sometimes what we think we want really isn't, and by the time we find out how wrong we are, it's too fucking late." She punctuated each of these words with a jab of her index finger into Vigdis's shoulder. Then, her wrath apparently spent, she straightened, tugged down on the hem of her jacket, and said flatly, "Now you stay away from Corwin, and you stay away from me until you're ready to treat us both with some respect and some maturity." Vigdis looked up at the tall, slim duelist and tried to form words, an apology, perhaps, or a concession, or something. But what could she say? What response could she give to all she'd just heard? It would take her days to even sort it out. By the time she'd even made a start at finding her voice, Utrina turned and strode away, and as Vigdis opened her mouth to call out to her, the duelist vanished in a corona of white light. Vigdis Brightblade slowly got up and crossed the room to where her sword stood embedded in the floor. She took hold of it, and with a grunt of effort, wrenched it from the stone. Then she looked around at the ruin she and her opponent had made of the Valkyrie Hall. The door at the far end opened, and in stepped a tall, gorgeous woman with a lot of wavy chestnut hair, a heavy, spiked black iron mace hung from the belt of her Valkyrie dress uniform. She paused on the threshold and looked around, her bright brown eyes going wide with astonishment. "Boy, howdy, V," said Gudrun Trumace. "When you pitch a tantrum, you don't mess around." The adrenaline was crashing as Utrina made the transition back to Midgard, and she was almost shaking as she emerged from the light back into the work bay. As she'd said to Caitlin after relating the story to Wakaba Shinohara, it never got any easier to talk about. And now, all unexpectedly, she'd had to tell it twice in as many days, once to her unintended second love, once to a self-declared enemy. She hadn't intended to say any of that when she chased after the Valkyrie, but at the end of their battle it was the only thing to say. Now that the adrenaline was gone, she was feeling very brittle, perhaps already broken. Not back in the horrible, raw-edged turmoil of the night before, but profoundly hurting, all the same. Belle, looking worried, and Corwin, looking almost stricken, glanced up from where they had been desultorily working on the mini when they heard the sound, and an instant later they were at her side. It hurt her heart to turn Corwin away right now, but with their newly voiced commitment to total honesty, she had to. She'd put so much of her burden on him over the last 24 hours, she wouldn't make him shoulder this, too, not in the condition he was in now. She tried to explain all this, her voice shaking, and he made her proud to know him once again with the way he accepted it. She embraced him, kissed him. It seemed so natural to do that now, after what had passed between them at the monolith, to show him that it wasn't a rejection. He made her promise that, if she needed him, she would call on him, regardless of what worries she might have for his strength. And she swore that she would, and then rode the elevator up to the house, praying. Her prayers were answered, or maybe it was just luck. Either way, the doors opened, and there was Wakaba, sitting on the couch with Sionji. Thank the gods they weren't necking. Even on a good day, Utrina didn't think she'd ever get used to seeing that. They were just talking, and they stopped the instant Utrina appeared, adopting near-identical looks of shock that would probably have been cute on any other day. "Wakaba," said Utrina softly, "I need your help." Wakaba was on her feet instantly. Sionji quietly excused himself, earning a grateful look from Utrina and a thoughtful nod from Wakaba, and returned to the dojo. Perhaps there was something out there that needed sweeping. With Corbin out of the running, there were basically two choices for Utrina. Two other people who she knew had the full story of her experiences during the Rose Tournament in all their terrible glory. Caitlin and Wakaba. Under the circumstances, for right now, it had to be Wakaba. Only Wakaba had known Akio Otori. Known him almost, but not quite, as well as Utrina. This was a shorter, simpler breakdown than the day before. It had at its core a combination of fatigue and raw nerves, rather than the shattering déjà vu and the horrid vividness of memory that had assaulted Utrina then. Wakaba said nothing, just held her while she got the worst of it out, then took her upstairs and put her to bed. Caitlin knocked at the door at 6, it was her room, after all, to inquire if everything was all right. She was informed honestly that it was not, but that things were improving, improving enough that she was admitted along with Serge. "Just like last year," Utrina observed with wan wryness to her roommate, whose tiger immediately volunteered for cuddling duty. "Guess it's your turn."
You've had a bad couple of days," Kate told her, patting her hand. "The new year will turn it all around."
"I hope so," said Utrina. "I don't like being this way. It's not like me." She chuckled. "Remember the time you smacked me, Wakaba, and told me that not normal was normal for me?" Wakaba laughed. "Well, wasn't I right?" she said.
"Yeah. Yeah, you were."
Utrina sat up.
"I wonder if maybe I should tell the others. The ones who were there, I mean. Sayanji, Miki, Juri. Maybe it has so much power over me because it's a secret. After the tournament, I've really learned to hate secrets."
Well, that's your choice," Wakaba said, thoughtful. "Only, I think Sayanji already knows, or at least suspects. He was part of Akio's inner circle back then, remember? And I guess in private, Akio and Toga liked to gloat." She sighed. "Maybe I shouldn't have told you that." Utrina smiled and put her arm around her oldest friend.
"It's okay," she said. "Nothing new I learn about him can hurt me anymore," she added. "It's the one benefit of having been broken."
"What was that line from that book we had to read last year?" Wakaba asked. "The world breaks everyone?"
"And after many are strong in the broken places," said Caitlin, nodding. "Hemingway." She sighed. "I hate Hemingway. But he had a point there."
There was another gentle knock at the door. Kate looked at Utrina, received a nod, and went to answer it. There stood Kyuichi Sayanji, wearing an expression of such concern that Utrina didn't know whether to choke up again, touched, or crack up laughing at the incongruity of that look on his lean, hard face.
"If you're interested," he said quietly, "dinner tonight is Sichuan chicken and the house mock fried rice."
"When?" asked Wakaba.
"Half an hour, or thereabouts."
Maybe I'll be down," said Utrina. "Thanks."
Sayanji nodded and turned to go.
"Sayanji," said Utrina.
"Hmm?" asked the green-haired duelist, pausing and turning back.
"Did you know already?"
asked Utrina. She didn't have to form the whole question. If he did, he would understand it. If he didn't, he wouldn't.
He did. He nodded, his face grave.
"Why didn't you say anything?" Utrina wondered. "You know, when I told you about the end of the tournament in Toronto."
"You didn't mention it," Sayanji replied. "It wasn't my place to bring it up, a thing like that."
Utrina thought about that, then smiled.
"Thanks," she said again, softer this time.
"You're welcome," Sayanji replied.
"Would you tell them I'll be down, but I might be a little late?"
Sayanji nodded again.
"And would you ask Juri and Miki to come up here for a minute?"
"Certainly."
And Corwin and Nall, she added after a moment's thought. And come back yourself if you want.
Certainly, Sionji repeated. Then he closed the door softly behind him.
What a guy, said Wakaba sentimentally.
Half an hour later, Utrina came down to dinner, surrounded by her friends, looking something like her old self again. Kate's parents, who hadn't the faintest idea what was going on, were heartened to see it. Her brave smile dispelled the cold breath of apprehension that had permeated the house since word of her confrontation with Vigdis had made its way up from the basement with Belle. Liza Schustal wisely identified a subtext in which she had no part, and kept her conversation light and funny, telling them all a side-splitting story from her summer of adventure. It involved 2 drunken Malons, a missile launcher, 15 Skrang, a river, and about 100 trout-like fish. R. Dorothy, the rest of Kate's siblings, and Sylvie Daniels similarly kept their own counsel. Utina noticed a meaningful question-and-answer look pass between Sylvie and Mickey, and in that moment she understood with whom Mickey had been having the private conversation Dorothy had told her about on Christmas night. In retrospect, she should have realized it sooner. Sylvie had been on her best behavior since Christmas, much to Guy Morgan's visible relief. Utina wondered what she and Mickey had discussed, never dreaming that it had been much the same warning that she had given Vigdis at the end of her rant. Feeling subdued and thoughtful, they all went to bed early that night, and with Kate beside her, Serge draped across them both, and Nall in her arms, Utrina felt almost as secure as she had the night before, and a good deal less tempest-tossed. Meanwhile, our Dorothy Wainwright experienced a very pleasant sense of déjà vu as, shortly after midnight, she found Corwin Ravenhair asleep in his workshop and carried him to his bed. Utrina woke the next morning feeling like herself again, her natural resilience and the healing power of a good night's sleep and a beautiful sunny morning erasing the cares from her face. She extricated herself carefully from the living tangle that was Kate's bed, brushed her teeth, showered and dressed, then came back to find Kate sitting up in bed, playing a tug-of-war game with Serge. Animals playing tug-of-war games always tended to sound as fierce and threatening as possible, and Utrina noticed that even at the tender age of 6 months, nowhere near his full growth, Serge already sounded pretty darn dangerous. Of course, it was all an act, as the tiger immediately demonstrated by getting into a comically underplayed wrestling match with Nall, who was perhaps a third of his size. "Just to make things sporting," Nall informed his sparring partner, "I won't use my wings." That night, of course, was New Avalon's galactically famous New Year's Eve celebration. This year all the Hutchins and Morgan kids were going to take in the Symphony Orchestra concert on the Grand Common, with their parents' blessing. They dolled themselves up in their best and warmest, it was supposed to snow tonight, and headed out at 7 to catch the N to the downtown area. At the station they met up with the Shannon twins and the Utonium sisters, and one station down the line they were joined by Fu Hooji and her elder sister Ku. Jaunty Ku was a bit of a shock to those whose impressions of the family Hooji had been formed entirely through association with polite, proper Fu, but neither sister lacked in friendliness. As they stood amid the throngs on the common, ate hot sausages, drank cocoa, and listened to Jerry Walker's New Avalon Symphony Orchestra rock the city center, Corwin, black eye gone, mouth bruise fading fast, smiled to himself. He, too, felt pretty much like himself again, but with one important difference. Their situation hadn't changed much. There was still the unfinished business of the tournament hanging over Utrina, still the specter of Anthihimemia separating them. But she'd said she loved him. Whatever form it took, it was more than he had dared hope for, and he would take it into the new year and rejoice. A thought suddenly struck him, apropos of nothing related to that line of rumination, and he leaned over and whispered to Liza Schustal, "Say, what was in that envelope V brought from your father?" Liza laughed, a high, clear sound of pure merriment. "Oh," she said over the sound of the 1812 Overture's cannon fire, "that was Daddy demanding that I relinquish my shares in the company, or at least give him my proxy for the next shareholders' meeting."
"Are you going to do it?"
Liza laughed again. She had, he was astonished to realize, a really nice laugh, and said, "I can't. I gave them all to Caitlin for Christmas." He stared at her, amazed, and then broke up laughing. Then he broke up again as he noticed that Clarissa Broadbank was standing, with a couple of her old gang from Crescent Heights Middle School the year before, a just less than discreet distance off in the crowd, staring balefully at her elder sister with sullen eyes. The concert went on. Midnight approached. As the crowd cheered out the count, Liza edged past Corwin and jury to stand next to Caitlin. And then, as the jubilant crowd cried, "Zero! Happy 2406! She seized the extremely startled duelist leader in her arms and, right there in front of God and everybody, but especially in front of the formerly sullen, suddenly popping eyes of her sister Clarissa, kissed her hard. Then Liza released her, turned to jury, and said with a grin, "Keep your shirt on, Red. That's all I plan to do." Barely audible through the cheering of the crowd as the orchestra struck up Sing, 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 jury replied with a little smile, "Your loss." Liza blinked at her, then threw back her head and laughed as Caitlin's face went bright crimson. As an unrelated aside, until that moment, Corwin Ravenhair had not known that Fu Hooji could dance the Lindy Hop. But she could, and damned well, as a matter of fact. They got back to the house at 105 Morgan Lane at 1:30. The younger trio, tuckered out, packed themselves off to bed. Everyone else went down to the basement den to have the traditional, well, this was the second time that made it a tradition, hot cocoa, and make their New Year's resolutions known. "I'm not going to let another year go by without finding Anthy," said Utena firmly. Then she cracked a wry grin and went on, "I've kept her waiting unforgivably long as it is. She'll probably never speak to me again." Corwin smiled. "I'm going to pass my trial," he declared, "and then help you with that. And I'm going to have really good seats for the whole thing," announced Nall. "Well, you're ambitious," said Wakaba wryly. "What do you say, everybody? Akio Otori's head on a pike by next Christmas?" Miki stopped his watch. "Sounds good to me." "Amen," said Juri. "I'll drink to that," Sionji added, raising his mug.
"Who?" said Leonard.
"Jerk from our old school," Wakaba replied breezily. "You don't know him." "Thank God for that when you say your prayers tonight," Sionji advised him dryly. Len nodded. "I'm going to make journeyman this year," he said. "It's not as ambitious as yours, but then I like a quiet life," he added with a grin.
"Journeyman by the end of the year. That sounds like an admirable goal," Sionji mused.
"Indeed, I'll strive for that too. Who knows? If we all work hard, we may yet find our dreams."
"Well, one of us has got to have a mundane goal," Wakaba said wryly. "I resolve to stop eating so much junk food."
"That'll be the day," said Utena, earning herself a punch in the arm. "I just want to go on vindicating the faith of the friends who made my Turing certification possible," Dorothy observed. "I don't need much more."
"I'm trying to be a more social creature," Juri Arisugawa deadpanned, making Miki Kaworu almost spray Corwin with hot cocoa.
When he'd recovered, the blue-haired duelist said soberly, "Maybe it's riding the coattails of Utrina's dream, but I want to see my sister again, and make sure she's all right."
Utrina smiled at him, nodding.
"You will. We'll get there. All of us,"
one way or another.
Kate trailed off.
I don't know, she finally said, after almost a full minute's thought. I'll do my best to help my friends, be a good master for Surge, bring honor to my father's house.
She grinned.
And maybe finish that damned organ fugue.
Mickey chuckled. I've had a couple of ideas about that, actually, he said. I've been meaning to discuss them with you, but we've both been so busy. Perhaps tomorrow? Kate nodded.
Let's make time, she said. I've missed working with you. We haven't done it as much lately.
Another resolution, declared Liza. As for me, I intend to look into opening that resort on Jezebel. And in the meantime, I'll go on making up for being such an insufferable... She caught herself, didn't say whatever she'd been planning to say, and said instead, creature, all my life. And making Clarissa's life as miserable as she tries to make ours, she added with a grin. Thanks for taking her off our hands, by the way, Leonard put in with a grin. It's been so peaceful at Koopman High this year. Bubbles hasn't had a single psychotic episode since Clarissa's been gone.
Well, don't get too comfortable, Liza warned him, because I suspect we'll be sending her back to you mid-term.
Oh well, said Len philosophically, raising his mug. It was fun while it lasted. Also, Liza added, looking ruefully at the blank spot on her wrist, I've got to get a new watch.
Utina came out of Kate's bathroom, dressed in her pajamas and ready for sleep, filled with the warm conviviality of a well-spent day in the company of good friends. Kate was down the hall saying goodnight to Jury, and Utina kind of wondered if she'd be coming back. Probably, she decided. Kate and Jury had slept together, in the strictest possible sense, a couple of times, but their relationship wasn't at the fully physical stage yet. They were being very slow, deliberate, and careful about it. Kate because of her past experiences, and Jury, Utina realized with a sudden urge to giggle, because she had, for all her sophistication and poise, no idea whatsoever what to do. The realization that Jury could be in that position tickled Utina as pink as her hair. She was still chuckling about it when there came a knock at the door. She went to answer it, and there was Corwin in his black and silver pajamas, one hand behind his back. Hi, he said. Listen, I was just on my way to bed. Nall's already crashed out on his quarters, but I have a late birthday present for you first. Utina cocked her head. Another birthday present? She said with cheerful mock puzzlement. You're going to spoil me, she added, grinning. Well, it's late because I thought of it late, only yesterday afternoon, but Aunt Belle really came through for me, he added with a fond smile. Anyway, I promised I'd help you find the real one, but until then, I thought this might cheer you up. He removed his hand from behind his back and handed her what it held. For a few moments she stood there, staring at it in amazement. It was a rag doll, plump, soft, and very huggable, dressed in a meticulous miniature reproduction of the Rose Bride's scarlet gown, as she'd described it to Aunt Belle way back when. The doll's soft velvet skin was a rich chocolate brown. It had translucent green buttons for eyes, a sweet little embroidered smile, and a neatly curled halo of purple yarn for hair. Utina blinked away sudden happy tears and hugged the doll, then the one who'd brought it for her. Aunt Belle calls her Raggedy Anthy, Corbin explained. I think it's some kind of joke, but I don't get it. I don't think she's so raggedy. Utina laughed.
Oh, Corwin, that's sweet. Though, she added, grinning, I wonder what the real Anthy will think of her. Then she laughed again. She'll probably think it's unbearably cute and want one of me. Corwin looked slightly abashed and admitted, Belle's working on that already. Well, maybe we'll give her one of you, then, said Utina with a wink. Corwin, thank you. It's sweet, she repeated. Weird, she added with a wry grin, but sweet. Well, good. I'm glad you like her, and I'm glad you're feeling better. And everything, he added, making a little gesture that encompassed the inadequate futility of spoken language past 2 in the morning. And I'm glad I was able to help. Utina smiled a fond smile, leaned and kissed him, softly and chastely, on the lips. I'm glad we're both feeling better, she said. Good night, Sir Corwin. Good night, Prince Tenjo, Corwin replied with a smile, and then he turned and went off to bed. Utina carried the doll back to bed and sat looking at the framed photo of Anthy she'd set up on Kate's bookshelf, Tiny Robo and Lesser Mazinger standing guard on each side, as they usually did here. Corwin must have borrowed Miki's copy for his aunt to use as a reference, and then Belle had winged it on the costume from her memory of a verbal description, rather than put her creation in the rather silly-looking Otori Academy girl's uniform. She hadn't done too bad a job, either, given that she didn't have any actual references, but then Belle was Belle, all but clairvoyant. She'd only missed out the weird furry things on the epaulettes, of which Utina had never seen the point anyway. The little chain and brooch were just darling. Raggedy Anthy didn't have glasses, but then that would have seriously diminished her huggability. And anyway, Anthy always had looked better on the rare occasions when she took her glasses off. Kate returned shortly thereafter, a little pink and smiling, with Serge padding at her heels. She saw the doll and spent a moment fighting not to laugh before she realized from Utina's expression that it wouldn't offend her roommate if she did. That's adorable, Kate said. Maybe we should get Aunt Belle to make a whole set of duelists to go with. Utina chuckled. She wouldn't be able to keep Miki in stock. True. Kate turned out the lights and they climbed into bed. Suffering only momentary discomfort while Serge sorted himself out, momentarily choosing a tail position that was somewhat inconvenient for Utina's continued breathing, but luckily amenable to a request for change. Then, warm and content, they settled down and drifted off, dreaming of the bright promise of a new year. This concludes Year-End Confrontation Blues. The symphony will return.